Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 9th, Wednesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Senate Leader Rebukes the RNC by Mary Claire Jelonek, the Associated Press. Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters arrested by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. And more sorrow for Schifrin by Howard Fendrick, the Associated Press. January 6th, Senate leader rebukes the RNC. McConnell criticizes party committee for censure of Cheney Kinzinger over violent insurrection by Mary Claire Jelonek, the Associated Press. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell is criticizing the Republican National Committee for censuring two House GOP lawmakers investigating the violent insurrection on January 6, 2021, saying it's not the party's job to police the views of lawmakers. As former President Donald Trump has downplayed the attack by his supporters last year, the worst attack against the Capitol in two centuries, the RNC last week took a voice vote to approve censuring Reps Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois at the party's winter meeting in Salt Lake City. The two Republicans sit on a Democrat-led House committee that is aggressively investigating the siege that has subpoenaed many in the former president's inner circle. The RNC resolution censuring Cheney and Kinzinger accused the House panel of leading a persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse, words that drew outrage from Democrats and firm pushback from several GOP senators. The rioters who broke into the Capitol through windows and doors brutally beat law enforcement officers and interrupted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory over Trump. It was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election from one administration to the next, McConnell said Tuesday. He said he still has confidence in RNC Chair Rona McDaniel, but the issue is whether or not the RNC should be sort of singling out members of our party who may have different views than the majority. That's not the job of the RNC. The dispute is the latest tug of war within the party over issues that McConnell and others see as politically beneficial and would prefer to talk about in an election year. Inflation, for example, versus the discourse over the insurrection and Trump's election lies. The rioters who broke into the Capitol were repeating Trump's false claims of widespread voter fraud and a stolen win, even after election officials and courts across the country repeatedly dismissed those claims. McConnell and his closest allies have said for months that they want to look forward to November 2022 when they have a chance of taking back the Senate and not back to January 2021. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas said Monday that the RNC has said it wants the party to be unified, and that was not a unifying action. Alabama Senator Richard Shelby said he believes the GOP should be a big tent. Republican Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Mitt Romney of Utah both contacted McDaniel to discuss the censure. Romney, who was McDaniel's uncle, told reporters that it could not have been a more inappropriate message from the party. Anything that my party does that comes across as being stupid is not going to help us, he said. Maine Senator Susan Collins said the rioters who broke windows and breached the Capitol were not engaged in legitimate political discourse, and to say otherwise is absurd. Collins said the GOP started out the year with an advantage on issues that could decide the election, but every moment that this is spent relitigating a lost election or defending those who have been convicted of criminal behavior moves us further away from the goal of victory this fall. The censure was approved last week after an RNC subcommittee watered down a resolution that had recommended expelling the pair from the party. McDaniel denied that the legitimate political discourse wording in the censure resolution was referring to the violent attack on the Capitol and said it had to do with other actions taken by the House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 insurrection. But the resolution drew no such distinction. Cheney said Monday that she had been receiving a tremendous amount of support in the wake of the censure vote. I think every American who watched the video of that attack and who watched the attack unfold knows that it was really shameful to suggest that what happened that day might be legitimate political discourse, she said. McConnell has maintained his strong criticism of Trump over the insurrection, though he voted to acquit the former president after the House voted to impeach him 1 week after the attack. In a speech after that vote, McConnell said there is no question that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of that day, and that a mob was assaulting the Capitol in his name. These criminals were carrying his banners, hanging his flags, and screaming their loyalty to him. His use of the word insurrection, the act of rising up against established authority, is significant. Many in his party have insisted that it was not an insurrection, downplaying the attack or trying to portray it as a peaceful protest. Former Vice President Mike Pence has mostly avoided talking about the insurrection, even though he was in the building as it happened and some rioters were calling for his death. But on Friday, he addressed Trump's repeated criticism that he could have overturned the election in his ceremonial role overseeing the electoral count. "President Trump is wrong," Pence said to a gathering of the Conservative Federalist Society. "I had no right to overturn the election." While few Republicans openly defended the RNC's move, several said it was the party's prerogative to take the vote. The RNC has any right to take any action, and the position that I have is that you're ultimately held accountable to voters in your district, said New York Rep. Elise Stefanik, the number three Republican in the House. "We're going to hear the feedback and the views of voters pretty quickly here this year." Heartbreak. Schifrin disqualified from her best event, two-time Olympic champion 0-2, by Howard Fendrick, the Associated Press. Beijing. Two-time Olympic champion Michaela Schifrin's second race at the Beijing Games was over even more quickly than her first. The 26-year-old American skidded out of control about 5 seconds into the opening run of the slalom Wednesday and was out of the event just like that. That was even less time than her 10-second or so trip down the hill in the first run of the giant slalom on Monday. "I was pushing out of the start. I had full intentions of skiing as hard as I could," she said. "I slipped up a little bit on one turn, and I just didn't give myself room to make any kind of error like that. I was planning to go on the most aggressive line, the most challenging line to ski." This time, Schifrin stood for a moment beside one of the gates she missed on a course set by her coach, Mike Day, before moving off to the side. She sat in the snow and bowed her head on her bent knees, the very picture of disappointment. Soon, a member of the U.S. team staff plopped down next to Schifrin and put his arm around her shoulders. Asked later how she was feeling, Schifrin said, "Pretty awful, yeah, but I won't feel awful forever. I just feel pretty low right now." Schifrin came to China as one of the biggest stars of her or any sport at the Winter Olympics. A dominant, at times, alpine skier who has been in the spotlight since she was a teenager. She has said she plans to enter all five individual races at the Yangqing Alpine Skiing Center and won gold would make her the second female ski racer to win at least one at three consecutive games. So far, though, Schifrin is 0 for 2, unable even to complete a substantial portion of the first leg of either of her first two events. But the slalom and the giant slalom are specialties of hers, technical races that combine times of two runs, and she already owns an Olympic gold from each. It is not stunning that she hasn't won a medal, let alone a gold this week. As Schifrin herself so often reminds everyone, anything can happen on any given day. What is truly surprising is that she has been so off her game so immediately in each of her two trips along the course known as the Ice River. It's really sad. It's never fun to go out, Swedish skier Anna Sven Larsson said. I know the feeling. Schifrin's next race could be the Super G on Friday, although immediately after her slalom mishap, she made it sound as if she might skip that race. She never has competed in a Super G at any Olympics, but did win it at the 2019 World Championships. What also is noteworthy about all of this is that Schifrin is known for being so consistently sound on the slopes, like a metronome that never misses a beat. She might be slower than other athletes on any given day. Sure, no one is perfect, but what she so rarely does is flub a maneuver in such a manner as to not even make it all the way down the hill. Schifrin has shared much about her innermost thoughts over the past several months via social media and traditional media. She discussed the ways in which she might emphasize when seeing athletes at the Tokyo Olympics, such as gymnast Simone Biles and swimmer Caleb Dressel, share their feelings about pressure and expectations last year. And Schifrin has been open about the difficult task of carrying on after the accidental death of her father, Jeff, in February 2020. After Monday's quick exit from the giant slalom, the first time she failed to finish in that discipline in more than 4 years, Schifrin noted that her preparation for Beijing wasn't ideal. There was a back problem that prevented her from training in October and November and a bout with COVID-19 in late December. Still, no one could have predicted this. Suspected of deceiving judge, Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters arrested, by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Grand Junction police officers arrested Mesa County Clerk and recorder Tina Peters on Tuesday morning at Main Street Bagels after she allegedly resisted during the execution of a search warrant. Police responded to the shop at about 10:45 a.m. in the 600 block of Main Street, where Peters was released at the scene pending charges, according to the Grand Junction Police Department. Mesa County spokesperson Stephanie Reese said the incident is unrelated to investigations of a possible election security breach in Mesa County. Mesa County District's Attorney Office investigators were looking for an iPad that belonged to Peters, according to the search warrant signed Tuesday. On Monday, Peters allegedly appeared to be using an iPad to record a court hearing in Deputy Clerk Belinda Knisley's criminal case and then told the judge in that case that she was not recording it, the search warrant stated. The judge had told members of the audience that he would take action if he found out someone was recording the hearing. If Clerk Peters had in fact made a recording, Judge Matthew Barrett's decisions and actions would have been influenced by deceit, the warrant stated. Knisley was charged in August with felony burglary and a misdemeanor cybercrime of unauthorized access, to both of which she has pleaded not guilty. The charges stem from allegations that Knisley entered a Mesa County worksite and was using Peter's computer on August 25th after Knisley had been suspended 2 days prior over an unrelated workplace conduct investigation. During a status hearing for Knisley's case, a deputy DA and paralegal said they heard Peter's claim in court that she wasn't recording and that those who accused her of such were not being truthful, but that they saw Peter is using the iPad to record or attempt to record and then stopping it when she was discovered, according to the warrant. If the evidence shows Peters did record and lied to the judge, she could be charged with attempting to influence a public servant, a felony. A spokesperson for Peters' legal defense fund said the legal team is assessing its options after Tuesday's arrest. The search warrant presented listed exactly one item, an iPad with a white case, Rory McShane said in an email. Clerk Peters complied with that. Then officers began attempting to take her items of personal property not listed in the warrant, including her car keys, which is illegal. In a video that a witness shared with 9 News from the incident, Peters can be seen struggling with police, repeatedly yelling, "Let go of me," and saying, "It hurts," as police restrain her. At one point, she appears to attempt to kick an officer, and an officer yells back, "Do not kick. Do you understand?" She continues shouting at officers to let go of her and give her the key to her car before they take her outside. The embattled clerk has been the subject of multiple investigations since last year. State and local officials launched a grand jury investigation into allegations of election equipment tampering and official misconduct in Mesa County last month after conducting a federal, state, and local investigation. Peters is accused of allegedly allowing unauthorized access to elections equipment during a Dominion voting system software update in May, as well as allegedly breaching election security protocols, after which passwords from the voting equipment were posted online. A judge barred her and Nisely from overseeing the 2021 election in Mesa County, and the Secretary of State's office has sued to stop Peters from overseeing the 2022 election after Peters refused to comply with new protocols. Peters is also facing state ethics and campaign finance complaints. Greyhound racing. State breeder used live lure training, by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. One of Colorado's last remaining greyhound racing breeders admitted to state investigators that he used live rabbits to train his dogs, a banned practice in the shrinking dog racing world that has prompted at least one state to open an investigation and cast into doubt the future of one of the country's premier breeders. John Lashmet, who, with his wife Jill, operates one of Colorado's two racing greyhound kennels, admitted to State Division of Racing Events investigator in December that videos captured by a greyhound advocacy organization show him live lure training in his Weld County farm or releasing live rabbits in a pen for the dogs to chase, maim, and kill. Lashmet answered in the affirmative multiple times to my specific questions that the video showed him using rabbits for live lure training, the investigator wrote in a Division of Racing Events reported by Grey 2K USA, the advocacy organization, and reviewed by the Denver Post. He was forthcoming with his information. 3 weeks later, Lashmet admitted to the live lure practice he allowed his license with the Colorado Division of Racing Events to expire, a department spokesperson confirmed. Breeders must be licensed in order to operate in the state. Lashmet did not respond to the multiple inquiries Monday. He told the Post in July that he used mechanical lures, not live jackrabbits. West Virginia, Arkansas, and Iowa are the only states in the country that still allow dog racing, though Arkansas and Iowa are ending the practice and will cease races at the end of this year. Racing regulators in West Virginia on Monday said they had received documents with Lashmet's admission that the case is currently being investigated. At the appropriate time, we will take appropriate action, said Joe Moore, executive director of the West Virginia Racing Commission. Greyhound racing rules in West Virginia prohibit dogs from racing that have been trained with live lures, he said. Violators could be hit with anything from a fine or suspension to license revocation. An attorney with the Arkansas Racing Commission also said Monday that he received the same investigative documents from Colorado. In previous cases involving live lure allegations in the state, a board of judges would conduct an investigation and issue findings within 6 weeks, said Byron Freeland, the state's Racing Commission attorney. The Weld County Sheriff's Office last summer opened an investigation into Lashmet's alleged conduct, but investigators closed the case due to insufficient evidence. The Division of Racing Events doesn't have the authority to enforce racing or training statutes, a spokesperson said, since those were revoked when Colorado banned the sport in 2014. Lashmet is still free to renew his license anytime this year. Carrie Thiel, executive director for Gray 2K USA, called for Weld County to reopen its case in light of Lashmet's admission and pushed regulators in West Virginia and Arkansas to immediately revoke the breeder's license. He needs to be out of the greyhound industry, Thiel said. That's the bottom line. It's unclear what will happen to Lashmet's dogs, at least 8 of which are set to race this week at tracks in West Virginia and Arkansas. People will bet on dogs that were very likely live lure trained, regulators know, were likely live lure trained and nothing is being done, Thiel said. And that's outrageous. This is an incredibly cruel activity that should not be allowed in any way, shape, or form. Racing regulators have made it clear over the years that the practice of using live animals to train dogs is not accepted in the sport, though animal rights activists allege that the industry has known about it and refused to crack down. The board considers the use of live lure training to greyhounds to be dishonest, undesirable, detrimental to, and conduct that reflects negatively on the integrity and best interest of racing in the state of Iowa, the Iowa Racing Commission, Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission wrote in 2020, ruling revoking one operator's license. Additionally, the board considers the use of live lure training to train greyhounds to be conduct of an individual whom is not of good repute and moral character. Greyhound racing used to be big business in Colorado, but as in many other states, slowly lost popularity as other gambling options and a growing animal welfare movement pushed the sport to the fringes of American fandom. Colorado hasn't seen a greyhound race since 2008, and in 2014, Governor John Hickenlooper signed a bill into law outlawing the sport. But breeders have still been allowed to operate in Colorado, even after prohibition, training dogs to race in states where it remains illegal. Newly redesigned Table Mesa King Supers to open Wednesday by Deborah Swearingen, Daily Camera. As the first anniversary of the King Super shooting approaches next month, officials unveil the newly redesigned South Boulder grocery store set to reopen Wednesday. With a new entryway, large windows, and lifted ceilings, the grocery store officials hope the new design will offer a bright, open market feel for people who work and shop at the store on Table Mesa Drive. The redesign also includes space for a memorial garden that will commemorate the 10 people who were killed there in a March 22nd mass shooting. The changes were largely inspired by feedback from King Super's employees and community members. As the grocery store began to work on its redesign plans, it solicited recommendations that informed decisions throughout the redesign process. The store no longer has a familiar King Super's design. Instead, it has a more natural light and open feel. That's all thanks to suggestions from the community, according to spokesperson Jessica Trowbridge. She said many people expressed a desire for a store with an open design and natural light that captured the view of the mountains. Instead of an east and west entry, the new design features a central grand vestibule with a large mural of the Flatirons painted by local artist Lael Haar greeting people as they enter the store. Other updates inside the store include a larger floral department, an updated Starbucks kiosk, and an expanded produce section. Additionally, the parking lot has been reconfigured with a totally new flow, Trowbridge noted. There have been safety enhancements at the store, but Trowbridge did not elaborate on any specifics, saying it was proprietary information that cannot be revealed without potentially putting the store at risk. We will remain committed to making sure that we have a safe working and shopping environment, Trowbridge said. For some, the store's reopening is a necessary step in the community's healing journey. This particular grocery store, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this summer, has been in Kristen Chin's life since she was a child. She remembers coming to shop there with her grandmother who lived in the neighborhood. Now it's her neighborhood grocery store. She said she's excited to have a convenient space to shop again, but it goes deeper than that. For Chin, the South Boulder King Supers is more than a grocery store. It's a community hub where she knows the employees and is bound to run into a neighbor. I'm really happy to see it reopen, although I know it will engender complicated feelings from lots of people, including, like myself, when I walk in, Chin said. Trowbridge echoed these sentiments. That's part of the reason the store has officially been dubbed Table Mesa King Supers. This is a special location, she said. The memorial for the 10 people who lost their lives is an important aspect of the redesign in Chin's view. Trowbridge said it's something the store heard a lot, too. She said the store received many suggestions to bring life into the space, including a lot of recommendations about planting trees. In June, the Table Mesa King Supers will open a remembrance tree garden in the west corner of the parking lot with 10 trees in honor of the lives lost. Right now, a sign indicates where the garden will be planted. Ahead of reopening on Wednesday, the Table Mesa King Supers will host a ceremony at 9 a.m. at the grocery store. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Martha Pat Gibb Bain, 1928-2022. Martha Pat Gibb Bain passed away peacefully early on Thursday, February 3rd, 2022, of natural causes. She was 93. Pat was born in July of 1928 in New York, where she grew up in Afterglow Farm, riding horses and competing in horse jumping competitions. Throughout her life, she kept with her the stall sign of her favorite horse, Sunshine. Later, she attended the Chapin School in New York City, from which she graduated in 1946. Pat married in 1952 and moved to Charleston, South Carolina, where her daughter was born, before returning to New York prior to the birth of her son. In 1962, the family moved to Denver and quickly became Broncos fans. Even in the early years when the Broncos weren't that good, Pat was always the biggest Bronco fan of the family, declaring often, "They're going to the Super Bowl this year," while her children rolled their eyes, knowing there was no possibility of that. In the 1970s, Pat went to work for Mike and Shirley Xavier at the Alpine Ice Center. Pat was also grateful for the kindness and support of the Xavier family and spoke highly of them throughout her life. When Alpine closed, Pat went to work for South Suburban Ice Arena off Arapahoe Road for several years before retiring. In retirement, Pat devoted her time to her beloved Welsh Corgis and became very involved in dog shows. Pat was a founder of Pembroke Welsh Corgi Rescue of the Rockies and spent many days driving around Colorado picking up dogs to rehome. She was also treasurer of the Pembroke Welsh Corgi Club of the Rockies for many years. Pat's last corgi, Bear, is a grand champion and now lives with Pat's son. Pat is survived by her daughter Cynthia P. Bain, her son William Bain, and her sister Jean Lee. She was preceded in death by her brother Lewis M. Gibb Jr. and her mother Martha C. Babcock and her father Lewis M. Gibb. A memorial service will be held at Horan & McConaty, 5303 East County Line Road, on Monday, February 14th at 2 p.m. A private burial will take place at the Gibb family plot in Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York. The family asked that in lieu of flowers, donations be made in Pat's name to Pembroke Welsh Corgi Rescue of the Rockies, which is coloradocorgi.org/rescue. To leave condolences, please visit HoranCares.com. Arlen Ambrose, September 29th, 1937 to February 6th, 2022. Attorney, father, grandfather, husband, an active civic participant, Arlen passed from this world on Sunday, February 6th, 2022. He was a tremendously devoted to and derived great happiness from his family. Arlen is survived by his children, David and Jody, daughter-in-law, Roxanne, and his stepchildren, Lisa and Lyle Jones, Andrea and Michael Banks, David Link, Kim O'Donnell, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his wife, Ruth Lurie, and brother, Larry. Arlen was a third-generation Pueblo native and lifelong Denver resident. He graduated from CU in 1959, followed by Georgetown Law Center in 1962. He served as a clerk for Judge William E. Doyle at the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals and was a partner and shareholder in the firms Ambrose, Porter, and Higgs and Hayes, Patterson, Ambrose. He was a member of the Denver Arapahoe County, Colorado, and American Bar Associations. He served in the Air Force and the National Guard and was active in civic life in Denver and a founding member of Temple Sinai in 1967, past president of the Denver Institute of Jewish Studies, and founding president of the Rocky Mountain Jewish Historical Society in 1976. Arlen had a rich and varied life. He loved gardening, puns, rhymes, and other plays on words. He was a master pickle maker. He enjoyed travel, photography, and was a member of the Rocky Mountain Stereo Camera Club. Arlen's presence in the AA community will be actively missed. Over the course of 43 years, he had been friend, advisor, and sponsor and mentor to dozens, if not hundreds, in the Denver community and touched lives of so many in significant ways. It was difficult to go anywhere with him in Denver where he didn't see and know a friend or an endless list of cousins. A private ceremony will be held Thursday, February 10th at Temple Sinai. A future larger celebration of Arlen's life is planned for this spring, details to be announced. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to his honor to Temple Sinai and or Planned Parenthood of the Rockies. Richard Irving Blight, 94, passed away on January 31st, 2022 in Lakewood. Visit monarchsociety.com for full obituary. Bruce G. Feynman, February 6, 1949 to January 31st, 2022. Bruce G. Feynman, MD, passed away at his home on January 31st, 2022. He will be dearly missed. Please check HoranCares.com for full life story. Colleen A. Graham, December 30th, 1934 to January 25th, 2022. Colleen Graham, 88, passed away peacefully surrounded by her loved ones. Colleen spent her life giving herself and genuinely loving everyone. She was an original member of St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Aurora, actively involved in children's programs, Bible study groups, the prayer tree, and other leadership positions. She volunteered for 30 years at Camilla Care and Sable Care nursing homes. She is survived by her husband of 68 years, Gerald, wife Sunny, three children and their spouses, Pam, Dave, Carla, and John, wife Jan, two sisters, Larry, husband Dick, Willa, two grandchildren, Holly and Johnny, and two great-grandchildren, Oliver and Grayson. Extended family members related through marriage include grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We remember her as the epitome of kind, selfless, and caring. Her hugs and smile are legendary. We will miss her terribly, but are comforted that she entered eternal rest with our Lord Jesus in heaven. A celebration of life will be on February 26th at 2 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church. The service will also be available via Zoom Enter meeting ID 875-4859-6133, password Martin. See newcomerdenver.com for more information or to share memories. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to St. Mark's Lutheran Church, 111 Del Mar Circle, Aurora, Colorado, 80011. Linda Makram, August 24, 1950 to February 1, 2022. Linda Makram of Castle Pines, Colorado, passed away peacefully on February 1, 2022. She was born in Falfurrias, Texas on August 24, 1950. She is survived by her husband, Jim, married for 37 years. Her two beautiful daughters, Abby Dorn, Kate Sexton, and two grandchildren, Walker and Casey Sexton. Linda came to Colorado after graduating from the University of Texas in Austin. Being a kindergarten teacher and first grade teacher, she had a true love for educating children at Pfeiffer Elementary School in Jefferson County for 32 years. Linda and Jim lived in Centennial, Colorado for 35 years and recently moved to Castle Pines, Colorado to live near her children and grandchildren. She touched people's lives everywhere she went and will be greatly missed. The funeral service will be a private family event. To leave condolences, please visit HoranCares.com. Jacqueline F. Patton, May 29, 1941 to February 1, 2022. For full obituary, service information, and live stream link, please visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Michael D. Prince, August 10, 1975 to January 27, 2022. Michael Prince, age 46, of Colorado, Parker, Colorado, passed away on January 27, 2022. For service details and complete obituary, please visit HoranCares.com. Marilyn Ruth Rickenberger, 1935 to 2022. She is survived by three children, five grandchildren. Please see newcomerdenver.com for more information. Jane Ruth Temple, October 8, 1929 to February 4, 2022. Jane Lynn Temple, born October 8, 1929 to Frank Willing and Bernice Bushy Lynn in Kimball, Nebraska, passed peacefully from this life into eternal life, surrounded by family in her home on February 4, 2022, at the age of 92. She was a faithful Christian woman who faithfully served God, her family, community, and beloved church, Cherry Creek Presbyterian. She was preceded in death by her husband, Charlie, daughter, Becky Lynn, and great-grandson, Carter Lefebvre. Jane is survived by children, Chuck Temple, Debbie McQueen, Barb Lorenz, and their spouses. She is also survived by nine grandchildren, their spouses, and 21 great-grandchildren. Celebration of her life will be February 12, 2022 at 11 a.m. at Cherry Creek Presbyterian Church, 10150 East Bellevue Avenue. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Golden targets sugary drinks. City joins Lafayette, Longmont in requiring water or milk as the default beverage with children's meals, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. Golden will soon become the latest Colorado community to require that restaurants offer a non-sugary drink like water or milk as the default beverage accompanying kids' meals, amid a COVID-19 pandemic that has pushed the country's rate of childhood obesity to unprecedented levels. The City Council on Tuesday unanimously approved an agreement with Jefferson County Public Health to have the agency enforce the new healthy beverage measure, which was passed by the council late last month at restaurants throughout the city. Golden joins Longmont, which passed its own healthy beverage initiative in September, and Lafayette, which was the state's first city to implement such a measure in 2017. Aurora approved its own measure on a first reading in March 2020 as the pandemic was getting started, but never cast a second and final vote on the issue. Golden's new healthy beverage initiative begins June 1st. Officials with the county health department will check for compliance as part of their annual inspection of eateries. This is just a start to reverse some of those unhealthy habits that advertising has caused, said J.J. Trout, Golden's mayor pro tem. We want to make the healthy choice that's the easy choice. Golden's ordinance would require that restaurants not list or show soda, juice, or other beverages with added sugar as the drink of kids' meals on its menu, but rather milk, water, sparkling water, or a non-dairy milk alternative containing no more than 130 calories per container or serving. The rule applies to chain restaurants and fast food outlets, along with local eateries in Golden. Parents could still order soda or juice for their children if they so choose. This is not intended to be laborious. This is not intended to be heavy-handed, Trout said. It's just a small step, she said, to counter the tens of millions of dollars that beverage companies spend to advertise sugary drinks to children each year. The Colorado Restaurant Association said it would like measures like Golden's to allow 100% juice and low-fat chocolate milk on kids' menus to bring this ordinance in alignment with the existing menus of national chain restaurants. The trade association is concerned about the cost restaurants will have to bear to reprint menus to comply with the law, especially after 2 years of bruising shutdowns and restrictions brought about by the pandemic. Restaurants across Colorado are extremely cost-sensitive right now, after 2 years of pandemic-related operational restrictions and decreased revenue, said Molly Steineman, manager of government affairs for the Colorado Restaurant Association. The cost of such an ordinance varies, of course, and relates to reproducing menus and website marketing materials, as well as the labor costs associated with training staff and realigning guests' expectations when they take their children out to eat. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a study in September of obesity trends during the pandemic. It found that an estimated 22% of children and teens were obese in August 2021, up from 19% a year earlier. Before the pandemic, children who were a healthy weight were gaining an average of 3.4 pounds a year. That rose to 5.4 pounds during the pandemic, the CDC found. The agency also concluded that the rate of obesity increased most dramatically in kids ages 6 to 11. The CDC reports that for children and adolescents between the ages of 2 and 19 years old, nearly 20%, or 14.4 million, were considered obese in 2017-2018. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Heart Association have both endorsed healthy default beverage initiatives for children, which have been enacted in California, Hawaii, and Delaware, as well as more than a dozen cities and counties in the U.S. While health officials urge children and teens to consume fewer than 10% of calories from added sugars, data shows that they are consuming 17% of their calories from added sugars, nearly half of which comes from drinks alone, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Suncor ExxonMobil. Judge, climate suit stays in Boulder Court, by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. The long-standing lawsuit in which three Colorado governments argue that the energy corporations Suncor and ExxonMobil knowingly and substantially contributed to the climate crisis must remain in state court, a federal judge ruled Tuesday. The ruling marks the second time a judge has determined that the case should remain in Boulder District Court, against the wishes of Suncor's attorneys to move the lawsuit to federal court in Denver. Keeping the lawsuit in state court counts as a major victory for Boulder, the two counties and their residents who are still recovering from fossil fuel wildfires, Richard Wiles, president of the Center for Climate Integrity, said in a release. Oil and gas companies are desperate to avoid having to explain their lies and deception in front of juries and state court. But once again, judges have rejected their efforts to escape accountability, Wiles said. Casey Norton, a spokesperson for ExxonMobil, called the allegations baseless and said the corporation's attorneys are reviewing the case and considering their next steps. Legal proceedings like this waste millions of dollars of taxpayer money and do nothing to advance meaningful actions that reduce the risks of climate change, Norton said. ExxonMobil will continue to invest in efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while meeting society's growing demand for energy. Representatives for Suncor could not immediately be reached for comment. The city of Boulder, alongside Boulder and San Miguel counties, sued Suncor and ExxonMobil in Boulder District Court, claiming the companies are responsible for billions of tons of excess greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. Moreover, long after they become aware of the dangers of climate change, the companies chose to develop dirtier fuel sources and sell dirtier fuels that create substantial more greenhouse gases than traditional fossil fuels, the complaint continues. As climate change exacerbated wildfires and floods in Colorado, Boulder alongside the two counties have suffered hundreds of millions of dollars in damage, according to the complaint, and they expect millions of dollars more in damage in the decades to come. The complaint cites the Four Mile Canyon fire in 2010 and widespread flooding in 2013 as examples of the damage caused by climate change. The lawsuit is seeking a jury trial and unspecified monetary damages to cover past and future costs of climate change. Red Flags Trailed Lecturer Across Elite Universities, by Stephanie Dazio, the Associated Press, Los Angeles. A trail of red flags about his behavior toward women followed Matthew Harris on an academic journey that took him to three of the nation's most prestigious universities, Duke, Cornell, and then the University of California, Los Angeles. Former graduate classmates at Duke and Cornell, where he studied before becoming a postdoctoral fellow at UCLA in recent years, described him as inappropriate and creepy, with obsessive behaviors towards some women that became harassment, in at least one case, sexual harassment. Last week, police in Boulder arrested Harris after he allegedly emailed an 800-page document and posted videos threatening violence against dozens of people at UCLA, prompting the school to cancel in-person classes for a day. Harris did not speak Tuesday during his appearance in federal court in Denver. Another hearing is scheduled for February 23rd, and a judge ordered him to remain in custody. His public defender did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In online class reviews, interviews, and emails obtained by the Associated Press, current and former students at all three universities alleged negligence by the schools for letting Harris slide previously, despite his concerning conduct. Two former Duke students, who spoke to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity because they fear for their safety, said that while they did not report Harris to the university at the time, his behavior was well known within the philosophy program, and they did not feel they would have been supported if they came forward. Taken together, the students' allegations at three top-tier colleges raises questions about the line between uncomfortable and actionable behavior, a university's duty to encourage the reporting of it, and an institution's obligation to prevent it from occurring at another school. The students' descriptions prompt another question. What, if anything, did the universities do to get Harris help? A graduate student at Duke, as he completed his PhD in 2019, Harris also attended Cornell for a year before UCLA hired him as a postdoctoral fellow and lecturer until he was put on investigatory leave last March after allegedly sending pornographic and violent content to his students. The former Duke students described their initial interactions with Harris as largely collegial, but with strange undertones. But Andrew Janiak, a Duke philosophy professor and former chair of the department, said he never had any indication of such behavior. Janiak received the first reports of harassment in late March after Harris had left Duke, and the philosophy professor immediately contacted UCLA. Duke and Cornell declined to comment. The signs were there. A house party at Cornell where Harris tried to rope a relative stranger into a discussion about his mental health. Negative reviews at his UCLA lectures. Odd interactions with women on the Duke campus. Incessant text messages and emails. No one would look at that kid and say, "Oh, he's fine," said Brian Van Brunt, an expert on campus violence and mental health. Typically, someone like this didn't just appear out of nowhere. In recent years, most colleges and universities have formed behavioral intervention and threat assessment teams in response to school shootings. Emails and court documents show UCLA's behavioral intervention team was involved, but possibly not until as late as March 30th. That spring, Harris began sending bizarre and disturbing emails. Emails to UCLA students allegedly included pornographic and violent content sent to women in his research group, prompting his suspension. UCLA officials said in an email that people at the university brought concerns to the Title IX office last year, which worked with the individuals to address the concerns. The university announced Monday that it was creating a task force to conduct a comprehensive review of its protocols for assessing potential threats. In April, Harris's mother reached out to a professor at the University of California, Irvine, saying her son in January had threatened in emails to hurt and kill the woman. The professor had briefly met Harris in 2013 while they were both at Duke, and he reached out in 2020. Harris's emails to his mother prompted the UC system at UCLA police to obtain protective orders against him. In November, months after he'd been involuntarily committed to a mental health facility and diagnosed with schizophrenia, Harris tried to buy a gun but was denied because of those orders. While schools typically cannot mention unproven accusations for fear of a lawsuit, lawyer Sonny Schuster said they can do a background check. It's not clear whether UCLA officials did so. The university did not answer AP's questions on its hiring process. Thank you for joining us for the February 9th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.